The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm David Thornburg, President and CEO of the Committee of 70, Philadelphia's longstanding independent advocate for better government. As you saw in the video, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity. From its award-winning author events series to its thought-provoking programs like the upcoming American Presidency Series, which will present compelling programs throughout the election season. Please visit freelibrary.org/support to make a gift that will help the library continue to produce such transformative programming. And while you're online, don't forget to sign up for a library card if, in fact, you don't already have one. So it's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest, award-winning journalist and best-selling author Juan Williams. Covering every major political campaign from 1980 to 2000 for the Washington Post, he's had a front row seat to and been a key political voice for the modern era of politics. He also lent his voice to NPR, where he served as a senior national correspondent and news analyst for 10 years. He's now a top political analyst for Fox News Channel and co-host of the daily news show The Five. In his new book, We the People, the modern-day figures who have reshaped and affirmed the Founding Fathers' vision of what America is, he profiles the 20th century American men and women who fulfilled the visions of the Founding Fathers. Walter Isaacson praises the book, saying, "American democracy is continually being reborn, and Juan Williams brings alive the impact of some of the modern-day leaders of this renewal. By portraying people of different backgrounds and ideologies, he has created a series of narratives that are both inspiring and thought-provoking." Juan, who I might add, is a fellow graduate of Haverford College, joins us at a fascinating, if not troubling, time in the history of our American experiment. Our presidential campaign is framed by anger, denial, and frustration by powerful forces from outside the political establishment. At the same time, as one who has succumbed, as maybe some of you, succumbed to Hamilton fever, 16 Tony nominations, I am struck not only by the popular impact of that remarkable musical, but also the energy and ambition of our founders it reveals and amplifies. In the popular response to Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, I find hope that the American experiment will continue. Juan Williams' new book, I think, reminds us that it is only through the continued vision and commitment of inspiring men and women that will enable us to realize that hope. Please join me in welcoming Juan Williams to the Free Library.
David, thank you very much. I appreciate that introduction. Thank you so much. I mean, you could have mentioned that I was my high school valedictorian. So what if I was homeschooled? No big deal. It's great to be here at the Philadelphia Free Library. I was here 5 years ago to visit and had a wonderful time. After all the trauma of getting fired by NPR, I was so afraid that people would come here with agendas, and it was just a wonderful moment where you could understand that people who love libraries as much as I do would come out and ask tough, honest, insightful questions, and I remain deeply grateful to all of you here. By the way, I was mentioning backstage to Laura that the first time I ever came into this library was when I was starting my journalistic career at the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin. And I was over at City Hall, and I would come in here, this is in the early 70s, to do some reading, to have a place where I could find books and just relax for a little bit. And so that was my first introduction to this library. And it still is the case that I love libraries. I think it was Jorge Luis Borges who said that for him, heaven would be a library. And I must tell you that I think for me, my angels would be librarians. So hats off to Andy and Laura and the staff of the Philadelphia Free Library. Today I'm coming to talk to you about my new book, which is We the People, the Modern Day Figures Who Have Reshaped and Affirmed the Founding Fathers' Vision of America. We're going to do some Q&A, so I'm looking forward once again to your energy, thoughts, to help me raise my vision, even of what I've already created. I think one of the joys of being a writer is learning and then communicating what you learn. But it's even more fun once you finish the book to realize that people keep giving you ideas, insights that make you think, oh, I should have written that. I should have done that better. This book, though, really begins with people telling me, and this goes back to the 08 election when President Obama was first taking office, with people telling me that they feel increasingly like this is not their America. People telling me, I feel like a stranger in my own country, and asking, what happened to my America? Now, at first, hearing that sentiment and hearing that I was first tapping into this in 08 when Obama was elected, you would say to yourself, oh, well, that was from people who couldn't believe that a black man was being elected president of the United States. And you might assume, therefore, say, oh, well, that's a dominant vein of thought coming from older white conservatives. But the thing about it was I was hearing this all over the place. And in fact, polls confirm that a majority of black Americans say the same thing. A lot of change coming in a way that was creating tumult in their lives. In fact, even if you broke it apart from race and started talking about people in political parties, it was true. Yes, 2/3 of Republicans said that. Stranger in my own country. Feel like this is not the place where I grew up. But it's the case that half of independents, in fact, a little more than half of independents, also felt that way, and 1/3 of Democrats said the country's just changing too much for my taste. The change is coming too fast. And when you would dig down and ask people about this change, they would talk about change in terms of immigration. They would talk about change in terms of economics, especially economics that, as we all know here in 2016, has resulted in tremendous rates of income inequality. And then they would also talk about the change in the politics. And this is where it really gets interesting for me, because you would see people say, you know, I'm just not accustomed to so many young people, more women, a more racially diverse group of voters, basically the Obama coalition, suddenly come to dominate in American elections. This is really evidence, to my mind, of what people are talking about in specific terms when they talk about too much, too quick in terms of the change. You know, the thing is, change is constant. You know, America's gone through the Civil War, obviously, Reconstruction, industrialization, Depression, World Wars, Cold War, economic transitions. You know, we've gone through everything from industrialization to the service industry to high tech to now they talk about, you know, pharmaceuticals driving the American economy and all sorts of physical and chemical studies being really at the cutting edge of what American industry and American economics are about. If you watch Fox News, you see all these commercials, you know, I think they really, so many of the commercials are for drugs and pharmaceuticals. You know, if this speech should last longer than 4.5 hours, you should seek immediate medical attention, I can tell you that. But even as change is a constant, I think what's distinctive about change in the era that we live in is that the change is coming so fast. It's coming at such a rapid rate. Buckminster Fuller, the futurist, wrote that we won't experience 100 years of change in this 21st century. He said, comparing the amount of change that will take place in the coming 100 years to the change that took place in the last 100 years is really a matter of comparing 100 years of change to 20,000 years of change, that there's that much change coming in the 21st century. Once again, then, I would say that we are in not only a period of historic change when it comes to our politics, to our culture, to our demographics, to our economics, it's that the change is coming so quickly. So in the middle of this storm of change, how do we get our bearings? How do we understand what is really behind the politics that we're seeing played out, for example, in this 2016 cycle? My suggestion, an act of imagination. You know, David was talking about the play Hamilton that is such a hit on Broadway right now, based on the life of Alexander Hamilton, first Treasury Secretary. Well, imagine if Hamilton came back to life. Imagine if George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin came back to life in this era. They'd be rock stars, right? They would definitely be invited to speak at the Philadelphia Free Library. They'd be on all the radio stations, all the TV stations. Everybody would want to know, what do these guys think about America in the 21st century? They created a constitution that has lasted 240 years. Did they anticipate this? What do you think? But also, stop and think for a second about bumping into these rock stars as you're walking down Vine Street, and they say to you, what are those cameras on the lamppost? And you say, oh, you know, it's for red light runners and for crime. And they would turn to you and say, you mean the government has you under constant surveillance? The government's watching your every move? And you would say, oh, come on, guys, take it easy. We didn't mean, it's not like that. And then they would say, you know, we were just in a bar over there on Broad, and guess what? We saw men holding hands. What an abomination. And you would say, hey, slow down. Gay people have rights in this society. Gay people can marry. And they would say, marry? Are you crazy? Gay people can marry? They don't even know what gay people are. They don't even have the lingo. The lingo is a mystery to them. And then they say, and on top of that, we see here in the Inquirer, it says that there's a woman running for president, and in fact, she's the leading candidate for the Democratic Party. Is that true? And you would say, of course it's true. That's Hillary Clinton. And they would say, we didn't have one woman sign the Declaration of Independence. There was no woman at the Constitutional Convention. Women couldn't vote, couldn't own property in our day. And you're telling me a woman might be president of the United States? And you'd say, well, yeah. And they'd say, you know, we created this country. We created these United States. But we don't know who changed our country. So tell us, who created America as you live in it in 2016? And this book, We the People, is the answer to that question. Coming back to the idea that there are political dynamics that are driving us at this moment, that are changing us, that have changed us to bring us to this point. And we would want to hand the Founding Fathers this book and say, here is an idea of how quickly and why the country has changed so quickly to bring you up to speed. So if I was to speak to them tonight, if they were so kind as to stop in the library and ask, well, tell me a little bit about this change that's happening so quickly to the country we love, I'd say, well, let's stop for a second. What did you notice as you were walking around today in Philadelphia? And they'd say, well, we already told you about some of those things. But they'd say, you know, it really struck us that there were so many different kinds of people walking around the streets. and say, well, what do you mean? And say, well, there are a lot of black people walking around, a lot of Hispanics. We can't believe the number of Asians walking around. And in the middle of the day, so many women who are coming to and from work. And you say, well, in fact, you know, it's about half the workforce is now made up of women. And again, they would be like, half the workforce women? I'd say, yes. But it's the diversity on the streets that I think would stand out to these men, these visitors from 240 years ago. And you'd have to explain to them that if you are paying attention to politics 2016, you have to be aware of the power of the immigration issue. That in fact, the man who looks to be the Republican nominee at the moment, Donald Trump, has used that issue to great political success, talking about building a wall to keep out illegal immigrants, talking about limiting the entry of people of Muslim faith as immigrants, and talking about even restricting trade with other countries in service to the idea of put America first. And you would say, immigration has changed radically since you were here 240 years ago. Because at the time of the American Revolution, over 80% of the colonies were made up of white people. Four-fifths of those white people were of British origin. The rest were from Germany, France, the Netherlands. In 1790, the law forbid anybody but white immigrants from becoming citizens of the new land. Of course, during that period, American Indians were not citizens, and black people were slaves. So the founding fathers would be just knocked out, like dazzled to the point of being dizzy, at the diversity that they would see on the streets of Philadelphia and the high rates of immigration. When I told them that 15% or so now of the population made up of people who are born in other countries and that it's at the highest level in our history, that would shock them. But if I told them, you know what, America's now a country of more than 300 million people. We're larger in terms of population than we've ever been. So that 15% in terms of absolute numbers means that we have more immigrants than the country has ever seen. And guess what? The largest single group coming into the country, not Hispanics, which are now Hispanics being the second largest racial group in the country, which would be a surprise to them again, but Asians, the single largest group now coming into the United States. They would not have any frame of reference that would allow them to comprehend that reality. So they would say, okay, who changed immigration in America? And at that point, you'd have to say, slow down, gentlemen. We're going to have to go back a ways. Go back to the mid-1960s and the immigration reform of 1965. And I have to introduce you to two Irish brothers. One of the brothers was President John F. Kennedy, and the other was Senator Ted Kennedy. And you'd have to explain how these two brothers, coming from Boston, had the experience of hearing in terms of family lore from great-grandparents and grandparents and parents about how the Irish were treated in Boston, the deep grievance that they felt as to how the Protestant elite treated the Irish Catholics in Boston, discriminated against them, demonized them to their mind, so much so that John F. Kennedy, when he is in the Senate and looking to run for president, writes in the ADL magazine, the Anti-Defamation League, he writes, quote, "The Irish immigrant here was the first to endure the scorn, the discrimination later experienced by each wave of American immigrants," end quote. Now, he wrote this for the ADL because Jewish activists at the time were also seeking to change immigration, the immigration laws in the United States, because of the strict quotas that had kept the U.S. from accepting Jews fleeing Nazi oppression and even the Holocaust. After President Kennedy is assassinated. Senator Ted Kennedy, then a freshman in the U.S. Senate, pushes the bill with, of course, the legacy of his brother as a primary force behind it, saying that the idea that the United States is the land of promise, the land that the Founding Fathers had advertised as a place where all men are created equal, was being violated by the current immigration law, and that people should be welcomed here no matter their place of birth. As a result, instead of limiting immigration to people coming from Britain and all of Western Europe, suddenly immigrants could come from around the globe, from Africa, from Asia, the Caribbean, and elsewhere, Latin America. And suddenly, the number of immigrants was bumped up. And the result is that today, in 2016, there are almost 60 million people who have immigrated to the U.S. since that 65 immigration reform. And that today we know immigration as an issue that, again, animates, some would say aggravates, our body politic. So no matter how you feel about immigrants, it's clear that you would have to say to the Founding Fathers, the Kennedy brothers changed immigration in America and put their stamp on it for all time. Now, similarly, I would say to them, gentlemen, you mentioned to me earlier you're surprised to see that half of the workforce walking around Philadelphia in midday is made up of American women. Well, I want to introduce you to another person that I would put on the new Mount Rushmore of American life, and that would be Betty Friedan. And of course, they'd have no idea who Betty Friedan is, but I would say to them, it's not just that women are half the workforce, it's that we have three women on the Supreme Court, a woman is the Attorney General, we have 20 women in the United States Senate, a record number, we have 84 women in the House of Representatives, a record number. And if you stop and go visit the University of Pennsylvania or Haverford College, you'll find that now more than half of the undergraduates in the country are women. And if you go on to the graduate schools, you'll find the majority of the students in the graduate schools, I think with the exception of engineering, the majority are women. And I could keep going in this way, that women have come to dominate in terms of higher education. And of course, once you see this reality, you understand this is a wave that's just beginning in terms of the influence and power of American women. And standing in front of you as a black man, let me say this is even more of a phenomenon in terms of black America today, that the achievers, by far, women. In fact, I would mention to them that I went out to a high school in Minneapolis to talk to students, this is several years ago now, about their view of American politics. And guess what? High school students in America don't read the paper, don't listen to NPR, don't watch Fox News. They're really not that interested in the day-to-day news. And I found the interviews going pretty much nowhere. But I ran into a woman at the school who had gone to the school in the 70s, sent her children there in the 90s and early 2000s, and now was working as a counselor at the school. And I said to her, what's the big difference in Washburn High between the 1970s and today? And she said to me, Juan, it should be very obvious to you. You asked to meet with the very best students here, the ones who have the highest SAT scores. You asked to meet with the student leaders here. You asked to meet with the best athletes, the ones who are getting scholarships to play sports at Division I schools. What did you notice? And my immediate response was, what is she asking me about? They're nice people. What are you trying to say? And she said, no, slow down. When you met with the best students, how could you not have noticed that 7 out of the 10 were young women? When you met with the student leaders, the people who run student government, the people who are engaged in volunteer services and helping people in the community, how could you not notice 8 out of 10 of them were young women? And when you met the very best athletes, after Title IX, didn't it strike you that you walked into a room where 5 of the 10 best athletes at the school were women? You know, and at that moment I was like, wow, how could I have missed this? Sometimes change comes so quickly, you just think of it as the new reality. But in fact, women had come to dominate at the upper tier of Washburn High, and we can see this throughout American life in so many ways now. But to the original founding fathers, this would be stunning. As I said to you earlier, no women signing the Declaration of Independence, no women at the Constitutional Convention. So how could I get the founding fathers, Hamilton, Washington, Jefferson, Adams, Madison, to understand how women have come to be the center of so much power in American life? And again, I think the answer, as I've written about it in We the People, is by way of introducing them to Betty Friedan. I had an office next to Betty Friedan at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington when I was writing a biography of Justice Marshall. And people would come and fawn over then elderly Betty Friedan. Some people would burst into tears. People would say, "Oh, Betty Friedan, your book, The Feminine Mystique, changed my life." And Betty Friedan was such a cynic, she would wink at me and like, "Oh my God, these people again," you know. But I really wasn't familiar with Betty Friedan other than Betty Friedan, the kind of popular celebrity. I then read The Feminine Mystique. I then began to connect the dots. And if Betty Friedan was my, I guess, office mate today, I think I would be one of the people fawning over her. Her book resulted from a survey she handed out at her 15th Smith College reunion, talking to women of her age in the late 1950s, and she heard about women feeling adrift in American suburbia, locked in marriages, fearing divorce that would end their lives, guilty about not being good moms because they sometimes were bored by their own children, unfulfilled as intellectuals. And she summed up all of it as a problem that had no names. The women's magazines that she submitted her article about the survey to refused to run it because they said it blew up the image of the happy American housewife. Betty Friedan's response was to publish the book. And let me tell you, I can say this with great jealousy, the book sold 3 million copies. And today, what do we see? Women marry later or not at all. We know about the feminist movement, about birth control, the sexual revolution. We see the consequential change in terms of family structure, the rise in terms of single-parent households. And of course, we know the rise, as I've explained to you, in terms of American women as leaders, voters, and consumers. These are just two of the stories out of We the People that I would hold up to the founding fathers by way of trying to explain to them, who are we as Americans in 2016? How did we get to this point? Why do these issues like income inequality drive us? But I'd also say to them, if you want to understand about those cameras on the lamppost, let me introduce you to the police commissioner of New York, Bill Bratton, and his theories of policing, identifying through computer statistical models where crime occurs, the time of day it occurs, who the perpetrators are, allowing him to use those instruments to be predictive, to use surveillance, not only visual surveillance, but audio surveillance to discover where crime is being committed. Let me introduce you to Milton Friedman, the conservative economist who put forward the theory that American corporations should be about one thing, making money for the shareholders. And let me tell you about the impact that has had on unions. And again, let me introduce you to George Meany, who brought about unions as a major force that elevated the middle class in this country during the 20th century. But let me tell you about the decline in the power of unions here at the start of the 21st century. Let me introduce you to Billy Graham and how Billy Graham brought religion into the political arena so that now evangelicals are a central voting bloc, especially on the Republican side. Let me introduce you to Henry Hay, the first man who organized gay rights as a political movement in this country. Let me talk to you about Rachel Carson, who raised awareness of environmental issues and environmental politics and led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency in this country and all the arguments that we know today about coal, fossil fuels, clean energy. These are issues, again, puzzling to the founding fathers. The first book I wrote, and a book that I celebrated here at the Philadelphia Free Library, is now more than 25 years old. The book was called Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years. It accompanied a PBS series of the same name. And I remember being asked here, Juan, why did you call that book Eyes on the Prize? And I told people here in the Q&A, I said, you know, I guess you guys don't go to church much, but this comes from an old gospel song. And the gospel song goes, keep your eyes on the prize, hold on, hold on. I know the one thing I did right was the day I started to fight, hold on. And in this book, We the People, you can meet and come to understand the people who have been fighting to change America. They affirm the founding fathers in terms of the great traditions of constitutional democracy. Everybody fights within the establishment mode. Nobody says, let's abandon the constitutional principles of the country. To the contrary, they say, let's live up to the Constitution. Let's live up to the idea of we the people. Let's live up to the idea of all men being created equal, as articulated in the Declaration. People today who understand the power that comes from being in the fight, from putting your hands in the muck and mire of American life and shaping something, can look back at the people who have shaped us to this moment and find inspiration. And in that sense, my prayer is that we the people would be a point of information and inspiration for people who go on to change America during this period of tremendous ongoing change. Thank you very much.
Juan, thank you very much for that overview. I think most of you know how this works. You raise your hand, we will call on you and get a microphone to you.
Hi, I actually have two questions. They're quick, though. First, I want to say, killed it on Bill O'Reilly last night. Totally agree with you about bathrooms. I've never seen somebody like hauled out of a bathroom by a policeman. And I don't think Bill really waits in the line, like the 20-minute line with the slums of us. I think he's probably in the VIP. But also don't tell him that because he scares me so much, but I've never even met him. So my first question is a little more personal. If you had to choose one of the co-hosts of the five to be your American race partner, who would you choose?
My American...
race. Wait, American... yeah. Isn't that called?
You mean, on the TV show.
Yeah, on the
TV
show.
Now I get it. It took me a minute.
Yeah, okay. On the TV show. I was like, I'm almost positive. I've been framing this for a while. I'm almost positive.
So they would have to be a good athlete.
Yeah.
So that would be Eric. Eric's a terrific athlete, right?
He was, yes.
Yes. And then the second part of it, though, is you'd have to be somebody who you would have tremendous trust with, right? Somebody who you'd feel was competitive and even could be, like, cutting.
Yeah.
Competitive. And so the answer would be Dana Perino.
That's what I was going to say.
Is that
right?
Because
I feel like she'd be like a little blonde general.
Oh, my God. No kidding.
And she'd be so scrappy.
You really agree?
Yeah.
I've
thought about
it. We're on the same wavelength there, yeah.
100%. Okay. My second question is, I'm also a writer, and you've had and continue to have an incredible career.
Thanks.
That spanned years. So obviously when you've learned a lot. So what's something that looking back at your career that you know now that you wish you knew when you first started out? It doesn't have to do with writing, just personal, professional, anything.
Sure. Well, you know, I remember, you know, as I said, my writing career started here. I mean, I was the editor of my junior high school paper, my high school paper. But then when I went to Haverford, I wasn't involved with the paper. I was telling David, my experience at Haverford was I was so afraid of the high level of academic competition, I was a little bit unnerved when I came. But pretty soon, I was working at the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin. I got an internship there the summer after my freshman year. And working there, and then I discovered pretty quickly, of course, the power of stories. But it was a comment from an editor then when I started at the Washington Post that sticks with me in terms of answering your question, because this editor, and it's something that another editor at the Evening Bulletin had said something like this. The editor at the Evening Bulletin was Sam Boyle. The editor at the Washington Post was Herb Denton. But the idea that they both gave me was, you know, you can write a letter to the milkman. This is kind of outdated, anachronistic, but people would have to tell the milkman what to leave, what to take, etc. The question is, can you write a letter, a note to the milkman that the milkman understands and executes properly? Well, part of that idea is that you know who you're writing to. The milkman doesn't want your greetings and to know how your day was and to know your favorite TV show. The milkman wants to know, what do you want and what don't you want? And in that way, a writer, I think the best writers know who they're writing to. Am I writing a letter to my mom for Mother's Day? And what does my mom want to know about in terms of my feelings, my life? That's a different letter than if I'm writing a note to you as the audience that I'm speaking to about We the People. Very different. And so you have got to think about how you develop your voice as a writer so that it's a voice that's speaking clearly to a specific audience. Now, you may say, well, gosh, if you're writing for a newspaper or you're working for a big TV network like Fox, how do you pick out that audience? Well, you come to understand not only who's reading, who's watching, but you have to trust that they are truly serious, curious people. I always write to the highest audience in my regard. I always think I don't want to disappoint my readers. I'm never going to underestimate their intellect. I'm never going to write down to the reader and imagine that they just want to be entertained or distracted. I think the kind of readers that would come to my books want to be informed and challenged in terms of the way they think and the way they understand the world. So I'm writing for that audience. Now, that might be a mistake. I think it will cost me at times, because you can write a funny, you know, kind of book and people will love it and lap it up and all that. But I think books that last, books that we remember, are books that help us to see a new world.
Thank you. I think we all know the influencers who are seeking to seemingly divide us and promote partisanship. Who in your mind are some of the influencers who are trying to bring us together and move us in a way, in a similar way, to the people you've identified in the book?
Well, you know, it's not the case that everybody in the book is necessarily someone that you would say is a great person or a positive influence. Since the book came out, now it's just a little over a month, I've had several people come up to me and say, how could Bill Bratton be in your book? Bill Bratton is a policeman. Why do you think he belongs among the new founders of the country? And then I have to explain, as I did to you in the speech, that I think that the way we go about policing, the way that we have balanced liberty and security, is an essential feature of who we are as Americans at this point. So these people can be controversial. There are people who don't like the idea that I've included Rachel Carson because they find the environmentalist and the environmentalist movement so objectionable, as you saw when Hillary Clinton went to West Virginia and the response from the coal miners. So there are people who, as I said, it's not the case that everybody's going to say, oh, exalt these new founders. In some cases, you may be angry at the new founders, but I think it's important to understand that these people were game changers. They were agents of change and have tremendously shaped who we are today. So in response to your question, I think that when I look for unifying figures today, people who I would say stand apart, you would look at people actually who are highly regarded by both sides of the political aisle, because I think political polarization is such a characteristic of 2016. And so you would be thinking about, gosh, only like, you know, 11, 12% of the American people approve of Congress. Most people see Congress as dysfunctional. Well, who stands above that static? Who is it that in American life people regard with great admiration and say, if only that person would run for president. Well, there are a couple people like that. The most obvious example, I think, would be Colin Powell. People think, gosh, I really liked him. I wish he had been willing to run for president, put himself out there. But you don't see it. I think there are lots of people today who you would identify as potentially great leaders who nonetheless, maybe because of family or whatever, say, you know what, I'm not going to get slammed and embarrassed and criticized and have my privacy violated in that way. They just don't do it. But that's someone that I think we all know. Then if you stop and think about, I think, some of the more intriguing characters, people who could never win in our current political environment, again, I'd come across, you know, we had a senator from Indiana, Evan Bayh. He's now involved with this purple state effort, which is to try to bring people together to the middle. But you stop and think about someone like Evan Bayh, who I think is a tremendous leader, but Evan Bayh could never win a Democratic primary. Why? Too conservative for most Democratic voters. So even though I think if he got into a general election situation, he would do very well if he had the support of the Democratic Party and was trying to appeal to independent voters, I think he would win, and I think we'd all be proud of him and see him as a unifying figure. It's impossible for him to get past the primary process, in much the way that the Republican electorate in this cycle refused to listen to a Jeb Bush because they saw him as too much of a moderate or even liberal Republican, which I mean, it's incredible, but that's the way they saw him. They saw him as status quo. He could not win. I think you have to look at people like that and say, well, who could potentially, if we lived in a different political time, would come and bring us together as American people? You would see these people like Bayh and Bush.
Juan, do you think the founding fathers would see or be familiar with the tension that seems to exist now between, and has been exacerbated as of late, between state and federal and the way that policies are being made and bucked by the states? And then, for example, the latest one was with the bathroom suit today, where the Obama administration is going after North Carolina, and North Carolina had sued. Does that fit within the context of the way the founding fathers would have seen the country, or do you think it's an aberration akin to
something? Oh, no. But it would depend, Andy, on which founding father you're talking to. Obviously, if you're talking to George Washington, he was a big fan of the federal system and wanted a central government. Alexander Hamilton wants a central bank, and he's fighting for it. Thomas Jefferson, on the other hand, a great believer in the power of the state and wanting to decentralize power to avoid the possibility of creating a new monarchy here, obviously, that we just declared our independence from an oppressive monarch in King George. So it depends who you're talking to among the founding fathers. But if we're talking about the North Carolina bathroom issue, as we heard in the first question, I think they'd be like, are you crazy? What? You don't know who men and women are, and you're letting them in the bathroom? What is going on here? So, I mean, again, it's just like beyond their capacity 240 years later to make sense of it, which is why the founding fathers would be rock stars, because they'd come back and everybody would be like, wow, you wrote something, a constitution that's lasted all these years, and the country is so different. And the critical aspect of this would be that they built sufficient flexibility in the amendment process into that Constitution that it could withstand the torrential powers that have come in terms of change. I mentioned earlier Civil War to Great Depression, the rise of people who would have been populist tyrants and demagogues, all of that, people who have been corrupt presidents. It's withstood all of that over the centuries. That's an incredible achievement. But there's no way that human beings made of flesh and blood who were slaveholders, who held women in low regard, would have any concept of an issue like LGBT issues. They would have it, some say about, you know, well, we don't trust the federal government, and we don't understand the Interstate Commerce Clause and why the Supreme Court allows the federal government this much leverage. They would understand some of the anger that's felt, especially by people who say on the immigration issue that President Obama has overstepped his authority. They would totally tune into that because they knew that tension between federal and state powers. but they would not understand the specifics of an issue like the bathrooms in North Carolina.
Thank you.
You suggested that white men are in trouble, and I would agree. And it looks to me like one of the things that Donald Trump has done is to become their voice, unfortunately, on the back of a lot of denigration of women and minorities. So what's the way forward productively for white men, or do you see one, or do you see them as such a disruptive force that the democracy's in jeopardy?
Well, I have to go home and talk to my son-in-law about this. He's a white man. And I would say that white men, what's ironic to me in this is that white men retain political power, economic power, cultural power beyond anybody in the American body politic and the American culture. They are still kings of the way. But it's the prospect, and I think the diminishment of what they saw previously as their state, and the sense that things are changing, things are slipping away, that leads to the unease. So when you ask me, well, what's the future here, I don't think there's a problem unless it's that you are filled with nostalgia and say, well, it used to be even better, and it used to be even easier, and no one challenged, or there was no sense in which people would question the authority. You know what I run into today, though, is in talking with white men, is they say, people don't appreciate what we've done for this country. And I think that's not true. I think that people appreciate anybody who's a creative force, who's an economic engine, all the rest. But it's the question of, are you willing to play with others who are not like you? And I guess the principal challenger in this regard is the American woman, and so it would be the white woman. But immigrants, and especially for white men who are in blue-collar industries, so lower-income white males, who feel very much as if they've been displaced, not only by women in terms of the workforce, but by the immigrants, by racial minorities. There's some anger at things like affirmative action, at not being able to say what you think in the ways that people used to, white men used to talk about the other in American life, that now you can't use that language freely and expect that it will be accepted and that people will laugh. Suddenly people feel, I think white men, I'm just surmising here from talking, that people feel like, you know what, there's more constraint and limits on what I can say, and it's all this PC garbage from their perspective, but I think they take it to heart as somehow lack of respect that they once enjoyed as the titans of the society. But to my mind, I must tell you, as an observer, as a journalist, I still think white men have the money and the power. I don't think there's much doubt about it. So it's really about this sense of loss, that things are spinning away, that it's not the way it used to be, which is why I think Trump's slogan, "Let's make America great again," really speaks to them and for them. You're right. He's their voice.
I'm interested in the way you framed the founding fathers' questions to you, and did you select them from your mind thinking this is what would blow their minds, or did you try to get in their minds in thinking if they saw these things, it would just be more intriguing than anything else, such as all the cars on the road or airplanes flying overhead?
You know, I think the technology obviously would be a marvel to them, without a doubt. But if you go back and look at George Washington, look at the Continental Army, and you realize he is told that one of his men has engaged in a homosexual act. His response is to drum this man out, to send him into the cold, away. He is treated as someone who is deranged and a pervert, right? So when it comes to something like gay rights, you understand he would not have any appreciation. he would view the way that we relate to gay people as not making sense, beyond rationality. And so for me, that leapt out. That's a huge change in American life, and it's why I tell the story of Harry Hay, in this book. Similarly, if you're thinking about women, I went through this in the remarks, they just have no concept of women as equals. None. So to them, the idea of women as the majority of voters in the last presidential election, 53% of voters were women, and the idea that you could have a Madeleine Albright, a Condoleezza Rice, a Hillary Clinton as the face of America to the world, you know, our Thomas Jefferson's, you know, Secretary of State, they would be like, again, just totally befuddled. So to me, it made sense to introduce them to Betty Friedan in this book, to try to help them get some grip. So it's not just my imagination. It's becoming familiar with these characters and then saying, what is it that would strike them as so not making sense, if you will? The same thing with Bill Bratton and the cameras, you know, the tension between liberty and security. You can see it in their writings, in their discussions at the Constitutional Convention, the Federalist Papers. For them, these are essential issues.
What do you think the Founding Fathers would think of the United States' position in world affairs and world influence?
Well, you must understand that when George Washington, in his farewell address to the country, advises that we avoid entanglements in foreign affairs, again, this speaks to the previous question, he would be so, I guess, disappointed that we have troops permanently stationed overseas in places like Germany, Korea, and Japan, would not understand it. And if you come forward from there, even in terms of protecting trade routes for American business, people like Jefferson would say, yes, we need to stop pirates and the like, but you expect us now to go into places like the Horn of Africa or the Middle East and to act as a world policeman? That's way beyond our interest and way beyond the notion of America as a sovereign state that respects the territorial and power boundaries of other states. I don't think there's a founding father who would understand or appreciate, affirm the idea of America as a world power. They would appreciate the idea that we were self-sufficient and that an economic power and engaged in trade, they were all for that. But the idea that we were sending our forces overseas and that we had a military that was, you know, seven times larger than any military in the world, would make no sense to them. They simply wanted to be able to protect America against the British and then subsequently protect us in terms of going forward against domestic enemies, people who would come back like the British did in 1812. But beyond that, they really had very little interest in having America project international influence.
How are you, first of all? Thank you for being
Thanks.
Here.
My pleasure.
And I came to see you the last time you were here. And
well,
I
thank you.
My pleasure. And I think you're very reasonable and very nice. But I have to say that I really, like, my son-in-law is white, too, and so is my daughter-in-law. And I can see differences. And I think maybe it's cultural, but I have to be honest and say that I just don't think white people get us. And I think maybe that's why we always seem to be a threat. And I'm wondering, and I'm asking your opinion about this, do you think that some of it has to do with education? You know, like, it's so different now. As far as, you know, what kids learn in school. And I just think that maybe if we approached education a different way, maybe there wouldn't be this disconnect or this divide between us. I'm asking your opinion about that.
Sure. Well, I think one of the big differences is education, and this is on several levels. I think in specific, older white Americans in general did not have the experience of growing up in integrated neighborhoods or attending integrated schools. And this is especially true if you're talking about the elite institutions, but it's also true if you're talking about, you know, state institutions. We know about the high level of segregation by zip code in this country. It's less now as you see waves of people growing. I mean, now black people are 13% or so of the population, Hispanics a little larger, but larger, about 15 or 16 and increasing. And you see Asians again increasing in number. So it's possible, even as we have continued high levels of segregation in our schools, it's possible not only to go to school with people who are of different colors, but also to watch on television and see people of different colors in all walks of life, to go to the movies, to go to a ball game and see integration and people working together as teammates and the like, to come here to the library and read books by authors of color and not view it as out of the main canon of American life. I don't think anybody would say that a work by Toni Morrison is not anything but a work of great American literature and not consign it to, oh, that's black literature. I don't think anybody would say, oh, Invisible Man is anything but one of the great books of the 20th century. That's a change, I think, for lots of people, and especially for older whites. So if we're having the conversation that I started my remarks with today by saying people who say, you know, this is not the country I grew up in, or I feel like a stranger in my own land, you're really talking about people who say, you know, I go down to the 7-Eleven or I go down to the gas station and those guys are all speaking Spanish. Doesn't anybody speak English around here? Or you talk to them about even listening to the radio or walking by the school playground and they say, those kids look so thuggish. They don't look like my grandkids. And again, I think there's a strong racial element to that, because their grandkids are running around, and oftentimes the biggest rap music fans are young white people. But when they see young black people doing it, it carries with it so much more of the threat. When President Obama was talking about Trayvon Martin and said, you know, there is a boy who could have been my son, I thought to myself, yeah, that's right. But I was surprised by so many of my friends, white friends, who said, why did he say that? You know, why does he introduce race into this conversation? And I thought, of course he had to introduce race into this conversation. The boy's a black boy walking through a gated community, and I'm going to tell you, a black kid's going to get a different response than a white kid. But again, it looked to me as if through my black eyes, this was so obvious, but it wasn't obvious to whites. Not to all whites, I wouldn't generalize, but to the whites that I'm talking about. So it has to do with a level, I think, education in terms of who you associate with, who you grow up with, who you come to argue with and debate with, disagree with, but acknowledge them as equals versus people that you have often seen from a distance and don't recognize as equals, and especially intellectual equals.
Please join me in thanking Juan Williams.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.